Good morning. This is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Elaine Baumgartel. The mind-body connection. It's all the rage these days with yoga and meditation practices becoming more and more mainstream. So what are medical researchers and practitioners discovering about the mind-body relationship? On the KUNM Call-In Show today, we're talking about strategies that treat the mind and the body. We'd like to hear from you. The number to call locally here in Albuquerque is 277-5866 or toll-free 877-899-5866. Joining us this morning to discuss this are Dr. William Breitbart. He is Vice Chair of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. He is also the Chief of Psychiatry at the Weill Cornell Medical College at Cornell University. We're also joined by Assistant Professors of Psychiatry at the University of New Mexico, Dr. Gray Clark. She is attending psychiatrist at the UNM Psychiatric Center, and Dr. Davin Quinn. He is medical director at the UNM Hospital Psychiatric Consultation Service. Good morning to you all, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Bill, Dr. Breitbart, let's start with you. You've helped establish the American Psycho-Oncology Society, and you've been lecturing on compassionate care for the terminally ill here in New Mexico for the past couple of days. How does psychiatric care help relieve suffering for terminal cancer and AIDS patients that you work with?
Well, thank you. Thanks for inviting me. We've actually been involved in organizing the American Psycho-Oncology Society, and it's also grown into an international movement as well. And I've been president recently of the International Psycho-Oncology Society. And the focus of our work has been to address the psychosocial and psychiatric and mental health needs of cancer patients. And one of the things that we've discovered, particularly with patients with advanced disease, is that when we think about psychosocial care and whole person care in patients with advanced cancer, it's not merely an issue of the mind-body connection, but actually an issue of the mind, body, and spirit connection. And if you think about the origins of the terms psychosomatic, mind, and body, Psyche is the Greek goddess of the soul. And the Greeks thought of the soul as the mind and the spirit combined. And so a lot of my research and a lot of research that's developing recently over the last several years is focusing on spiritual and existential aspects of care, particularly of terminally ill patients who are facing existential and spiritual crises. And we're just trying to develop interventions that are sort of secular, that focus on the use of the concepts of meaning as a secular, non-religious language in which psychiatrists, psychologists, mental health professionals, and others can work with cancer patients around these issues that are confronting them in this very important, existentially meaningful time in their lives.
Yeah, well, I was thinking about the time around the death of an individual for family members and for that individual themselves is kind of this liminal period where there's a transition taking place, not just for the person who is dying, but for everyone in their community and circle and family. How does psychiatric work specifically address some of the challenges that happen both for the individual who's dying and for family members?
Well, you're correct in the sense that as cancer, as a disease advances, it becomes more and more evident that this is an illness that affects an entire family. It's always an illness that affects the entire family from the beginning, but particularly in the last stages of disease. So the unit of care really is the family and the patient. But I think when you speak about this liminal space, the space that's between life and death, I think there's a prejudice amongst my colleagues, at least before the last 10 years or so, in which we basically thought that this was a period of time in a patient's life, in the life of a family, in which not much could be accomplished, not much positive could be accomplished. And there was I remember being taught by my mentor that patients die the way they live, and that there was no potential for change or growth or transcendence. And in fact, what we've discovered is that the urgency of facing death,
mortality,
mortality actually results in a period of time in which great transformation and great change can take place, perhaps even more so than in other times in life. And so this is a period of time where I think very powerful and meaningful things can take place in a patient's and a family's life, things related to forgiveness, redemption, completion of end-of-life tasks, being able to take a look at what death does, facing death does. It's death is like a wall. It forces you to turn around and look at the life that you've lived. And the task is to accept that life you live.
I'm thinking about the book The Prophet by Khalil Gibran, where he writes, you know, the lute that is carved with knives is then what produces music. The potter's cup, which is burnt in the fires of the oven, then holds the wine or the water. And for many of your patients, not only is there the impending mortality, but there's also a great amount of pain, physical pain and suffering. Can you talk about how physical pain and suffering contributes to this moment of opportunity that you're describing?
Sure. Well, I think that when there's no such thing as necessary pain, a physical pain, physical pain must be controlled. And I see no advantage to suffering that comes from pain that can be controlled. But inevitably, when one is confronting death, there are elements of suffering that are unavoidable. Just the phenomenon of confronting the limitations of death causes suffering. Carl Jaspers, the famous psychiatrist, called suffering any confrontation with limitation, and death is an ultimate limitation. So any time we encounter limitation, we suffer. So suffering is inevitable. And Viktor Frankl, whose work I based my meaning-centered psychotherapy on, basically talks about the attitude, being able to choose the attitude you take towards suffering as being a very important, profound source of meaning.
Can you give an example?
The ability to turn a tragedy into a personal triumph.
What do you find when you're working with people that is kind of one of the greatest misunderstandings about the experience of dying that your patients move through or grow to understand as part of their dying process?
I think one of the greatest misunderstandings, not only amongst patients and family members, but amongst clinicians, is that once a patient loses the hope for cure, that they are then utterly, completely hopeless. And the fact of the matter is that when you lose the hope for cure, that quickly gets replaced with multiple other hopes that are profoundly important. The hope not to die in pain, the hope to not to die alone, the hope to die in your own home, surrounded by your family. So there are very profound hopes that aren't to be neglected or minimized. So once you lose the hope for cure, it's replaced by very important other hopes.
Dr. William Breitbart is the vice chair of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York, and he's in town this week working with medical and psychiatry students at the University of New Mexico Hospital and UNM Psychiatric Center. We also have in the studio this morning Dr. Gray Clark. She is the attending psychiatrist or an attending psychiatrist at the UNM Psychiatric Center. And we're also joined by Dr. Davin Quinn. He is medical director at the UNM Hospital Psychiatric Consultation Service. Davin, can you set us up with a definition of psychosomatic medicine? The UNM Psychiatry Department has recently been approved to offer a fellowship in psychosomatic medicine. You know, in my experience, this term psychosomatic has often been used in common conversation to refer to someone who isn't really sick, but who thinks that they are. So can you explain what the term means and some of the misuses of the term?
Sure, I'll do my best, and I invite Gray and Bill to jump in if they have further comments, because I'm sure I'll leave something out. But psychosomatic medicine, as it's encapsulated in our training program, which we just developed, goes a bit beyond the lay use of the term psychosomatic. So people usually think of psychosomatic to mean something's going on in your head psychologically, which causes you to have a physical symptom. So we're actually concerned with much more than that, although we are concerned with phenomena like that as well. We're also interested in medical manifestations of medical conditions that look psychiatric. So, for instance, when someone has depression due to a brain tumor. We also are interested in reactions to medical conditions. So, for instance, when you receive a diagnosis, you may have a psychological reaction, such as anxiety or depression. There are also complications that result from medical conditions or treatment that we may administer in the hospital or in the clinic. For instance, the treatment for hepatitis C is interferon, which is known to actually induce a depressive state in many patients who receive it. So that encapsulates about probably 50 to 60% of what we usually deal with. And then on the other side, we see what I just alluded to before, medical presentations of psychiatric or psychological conditions where people may have paralysis or weakness or symptoms that can't be explained by something physical going on, actually better explained by something either psychological. So that's what we busy ourselves with on the service.
Gray, I want to go to you now. Of course, this kind of seems like common sense, right, that there would be a relationship between our psychology and our physical health, that, you know, everything that we experience is also a product of our organism in the world. And I'm thinking about how we all get sick. We all get a cold sometime, or, you know, we may have other kinds of health challenges in our lives. But there is not this idea that we all get mentally sick sometimes, too, that we all may feel depressed sometime or anxious sometimes or have reactions to experiences in our lives that could be considered a mental illness. Can you talk a little bit about that stigma of mental illness and how that relates to your work in psychosomatic medicine?
Well, absolutely. The stigma is still really alive and well, as we all know, about mental illness, even more so than physical illness. So often in my work in psychosomatic medicine, the entry into talking about emotional lives and even stress is through the physical component of it. And people are willing to talk about that easily.
Less so than if you're like, oh, you have a mental illness right now since you're feeling depressed.
Exactly. Right. So that's sort of the invitation. And, you know, this is a little bit different off the topic, but I was talking with Dr. Barry Ramo the other day as I was on his television show, and he was saying to me, people don't tell him about stress in their lives. They don't even talk about the kind of environmental things they're facing. As a psychiatrist, it's completely different. I mean, people come to us, and that's the easiest thing to talk about is this is my life stress here. And so it's really a privilege to be able to have that kind of opening. Then when you're working with somebody on that level and they start to have a medical condition, that is an entirely new invitation to talk about death and life and meaning. It just opens up the whole world of spirit there.
We're talking about the mind, body, and spirit relationship with doctors of psychosomatic medicine this morning. Do you have a preconceived notion of what psychosomatic illness is? Give us a call. The number is 277-5866 locally here in Albuquerque. You can also call toll-free 877-899-5866. And we have Glenn on the line from Jemez Springs. Good morning, Glenn.
Good morning. Thanks for this program, and I was really appreciating the doctor starting off by adding spirit to the mix. I had a Bible-reading grandma from Germany, and, man, I felt her spirit, I was able to be part of African-American churches in St. Louis, and certainly the spirit comes through there. For me, Gandhi and Martin Luther King, my dying mother last year, and singing to her. The chanting here in our Buddhist temple in Jemez Springs, one feels the spirit. Our praying in our churches here. Yesterday I was up on top of our mesa here around the holy sites of the Kivas from way back and feeling the spirit. I have a question for each of your three people. Would they be so risky as to talk about their own spirituality, what they do, how they feed their spirits?
Thanks, Glenn. Bill?
Well, that's a very interesting question. Thanks for your call and your comments. I think that my spiritual practice actually involves my work with patients, and I'm quite privileged to be involved in very intimate, profound, and sacred moments with patients and their families. And I learned so much from my patients and their courage that is actually my main spiritual practice, my daily clinical practice with patients. I leave feeling very privileged to be alive.
Mm-hmm. Devin?
Sure. I guess just in mulling over this great question for the past 30 seconds, I would say that I have sort of an eclectic view of my own spirituality. My father was raised Roman Catholic. My mother was raised as a Buddhist. I myself sort of try to incorporate aspects of both of those traditions into how I think and feel and behave. I think there's also a lot to be said for the complementary and alternative modalities that exist. I do yoga occasionally, you know, try to exercise and get out into nature. So it's really not any one tradition. I seem to, you know, have gravitated towards various things in different traditions.
Mm-hmm. Gray, do you have comments on that?
I do. You know, my spirituality really, I'm in touch with it when I work with my patients, and especially around death and, you know, catastrophic illness. And also through the experience of my grandmother dying, I was really in touch with what my faith was and what love is about and what that means and what my faith means to me as well.
Does psychosomatic medicine, this field, it's relatively new, is it kind of healing the Western culture mind-body split in your mind? Is there a cultural process that is taking place in addition to a medical field growing?
I recently spent a term as the president of our Academy of Psychosomatic Medicine, so the National Organization of Psychosomatic Medicine Psychiatrists, and we're about a 60, 65-year-old organization, although psychosomatic medicine goes back a bit further, almost 100 years. And the theme of my presidential...
Well, of course, I think 100 years is just like a baby.
That's right.
Right.
And the theme of the scientific meeting in which I was present was the integration of the mind, body, and spirit connection. And believe it or not, I think it was the first time that we at the Academy had such an overt scientific program which focused on that mind-body-spirit connection. And the meeting was really full of presentations and scientific papers and research which demonstrated the importance of existential concepts like being able to sustain meaning and faith and things like that on medical outcomes and on quality of life and on such issues as anxiety and depression and hopelessness and demoralization in various populations, a lot on cancer and AIDS and things like that. So it was the first opportunity to really start to integrate all three and present the scientific and evidence-based information on this subject.
Let's take another call. Jack in Santa Fe. Good morning, Jack. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it. I find this topic very interesting. I would like to hear a comment or two about post-traumatic stress disorder. I personally have been diagnosed with it, and about 30 years ago, the doctors at the VA hospital in San Francisco basically told me I had a Valium deficiency. That's changed a great deal, but that doesn't really address the underlying issues of PTSD. So I'd be curious. I've had other experiences with that kind of chemicals and drug prescriptions, and for me, they have not been particularly pleasant. It's really zoned me down or tried to level me off. So I'll take my answer off the air if you'd like to comment on it. Thank you.
Thanks, Jack.
Sure, I'll jump in on
Devin.
That. Yeah. first of all, we see a great deal of PTSD in the population that comes to University of New Mexico Hospital. So it's a problem that we're encountering every day. And it really is a wonderful exemplar of a psychosomatic condition or phenomenon, because here you have something that happened in your life and it caused such an impression on your mind and your body that impression lingers way beyond the event.
So this is post-traumatic stress disorder that we're talking about. And it's something that I think we may kind of generally tend to associate with people who've served in the military. But can you also broaden that out a little bit to, some other patients who experience this disorder? And what kinds of traumas are you talking about that you see in the population here in New Mexico?
Sure. So first of all, UNM is the state's only level one trauma center. So physical traumas are all brought to UNM, so we are often seeing those patients, motor vehicle accidents, burn injuries, electrical injuries, assaults, traumatic brain injuries. So that's why we get to see a lot of it, and it's really an opportunity for us to use a multidisciplinary, multimodal approach to try and help people with that. So in the acute phases of someone coming in after experiencing trauma, we're more interested in just stabilizing their physical condition, stabilizing their vital signs, making sure that all the important elementary physical bodily needs are taken care of. And then as the patient starts to emerge from that acute phase, we're able to start asking them, how is this affecting you? How are you dealing with this? What's happened to you? And what do you think's happened to you? So, and at that time, people will often tell us, I'm having trouble sleeping, I'm having nightmares, I'm having flashbacks about the accident or about what happened to me. I don't want to talk to anyone, I don't want to get near anyone. Every time someone would walk into the room, I have a startle reflex. So in those times, we try to use what we often use in psychiatry, a biopsychosocial approach. So biologically, we'll look at, are there certain medicines that might be able to temporarily decrease the startle response, decrease their anxiety, decrease the nightmares that they're having. Psychologically, we try to use, for nightmares, a very effective technique is nightmare rehearsal. So you ask them, just go over your nightmare, write it down when you're awake. And that seems to, just that simple act of writing it down seems to reduce the number of nightmares that people have. And then socially, finding support, finding meaning, finding things that help you get back in touch with the life that you had before this trauma happened to you. That may have very little to do with psychiatry. In fact, more involve the people in your life, like your family, your friends, spiritual counselors.
If you'd like to join the conversation this morning, you can call 277-5866 locally here in Albuquerque. You can also call toll-free 877-899-5866. We've got three doctors of psychosomatic medicine in the studio this morning, and we're talking about the mind-body-spirit relationship in medicine. And let's take another call. Only, you're on the air this morning. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I was just wondering where a person goes to get this particular type of care, this, where do you go for this?
Mm-hmm.
You don't just go to Walgreens, do you?
Right. Are there clinics? Are there opportunities for people to choose to receive psychosomatic medical treatment in a way that they could choose to see a psychiatrist or choose to see So you can call up your psychosomatic medical doctor.
Yes, there are specialists, but maybe Davin can talk about.
Yeah, we have a clinic at University Psychiatric Center that is specifically for these kinds of problems that we're talking about. And so it's readily available.
And so, and that would be, talk a little bit more about how people would have access to that.
I can give you the telephone number, 272-2800. Davin, do I have that right?
272-1700 is the general clinic number. It's called the Somatic Disorders Clinic. And we bring people in who we've seen in the hospital for a psychosomatic consultation. We also get referrals from other specialists and general practitioners in the area. I would say that other opportunities to access this kind of treatment exist just by going and seeing practitioners who specialize in using a holistic approach to patient care by looking at who pay attention to the mind-body connection. So we have these services at UNM, but I would also encourage people to try and utilize and seek out practitioners in their area who are attuned to and perhaps knowledgeable about this.
Let me just add one more thing, is that I think the importance of our new training program in psychosomatic medicine is going to expand our ability to outreach different physicians, and so that we'll be able to train other physicians in how to do this kind of medicine.
Expand the network.
Exactly.
In a sense. Yeah. Great. Let's take another call. Chris in Albuquerque. Good morning. You're on the air.
Thank you. Good morning thank you for taking my call. I love the show, and I've never called in before. I've worked in hospice and home health care for a little bit now, and I've seen from my experience at work and my personal experience this relationship between physics and metaphysics and how thought seems to really affect, like a bridge between the two. My question is about the psychosomatic clinic and program. Has there been work or research done to show how thought or attitude or behavior of not accepting the clinical diagnoses or not accepting the death sentence, as it were, how that has affected somebody's choices or life or longevity after that? For example, I've seen people, and myself too, I've been told to put my final affairs in order several times over the last 25 years, and I've just rejected it. I said, no, I don't think that's really true. And here it is, two children later and so forth. And I just stopped going to doctors myself. And I've seen that with my clients too, although I keep my personal experiences to myself with them. I'm wondering if there's any research or any exploration into how thought can also, or opinion or attitude also affect somebody's longevity or somebody's choice to not accept the health role of a sick individual. And then I'll listen to your answers off the air. Thank you.
Bill, this is that, you know, denial is not,
yes,
you know, it's not just a river in Egypt, right?
Right. Denial is a very helpful defense mechanism, and it allows us to function in life, in a life that's quite dangerous and where we have a lot of vulnerabilities. But the specific answer to your question is that there is a growing body of research, particularly in patients with advanced cancer and patients who are on hemodialysis, for instance, which shows, for instance, that if the less insight you have into your terminal prognosis, the less less prognostic awareness you have, the more likely you are to be depressed and to be anxious and distressed, and the less likely you are to do things like create an advanced directive. And very often patients end up being intubated in an intensive care unit in the last days of their life when that was not their intention. There have been several other studies showing that prognostic awareness allows for a better grief and bereavement experience for patients' families. So there is a growing body of literature that suggests that being able to confront mortality, be aware of it, and not constantly, but to look at it for a moment and to respond to it and plan for it in an appropriate way has better outcomes.
Well, and there's also the fear and anxiety that's associated with feeling ill or having symptoms that sometimes prevents people from getting care.
That's true.
That there are people who don't go to get care out of fear of finding out.
Sure.
Particularly
amongst minority populations, one of the factors that relates to increased mortality from certain cancers, for instance, comes from the fact that these cancers often get diagnosed in later stages, as opposed to earlier stages.
Much more advanced stages, right. Mm-hmm. We're talking with Dr. William Breitbart. He is vice chair of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. Also joining us this morning are assistant professors of psychiatry at the University of New Mexico, Dr. Gray Clark and Dr. Davin Quinn. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with some of your calls.
Support comes from Saggio's, homemade real Italian pizza, calzones, pasta, salads, and desserts, serving Albuquerque and the UNM community since 1968. Saggio's encourages support of public radio KUNM on Cornell Southeast across from UNM and at saggios.com.
Did you resolve to make 2012 the year you'd clear out stuff you don't need anymore? If you have an old car, truck, boat, motorcycle, or farm equipment that isn't worth fixing, we can help you keep that New Year's resolution. Just call 888-KUNM-CAR. We'll tow it away, sell it, and send you a tax receipt. Plus, you'll get a KUNM membership good through the rest of the year. Just call 888-KUNM-CAR. That's 888-KUNM-CAR.
I'm Elaine Baumgartel. This is the KUNM Call-In Show, and we've got three doctors of psychosomatic medicine in the studio with us this morning, Bill Breitbart, Gray Clark, and Davin Quinn. And let's go to some of your calls now. David in La Cienega, good morning. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. My question concerns serious mental illnesses such as...
Oh, you know, David, it sounds like we lost you. Our connection wasn't so good. If you could try to give us a call back, that would be great. Let's go to Brenda in Rio Rancho. Good morning, Brenda. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. My question I'd like to direct to Dr. Gray Clark or all three of them. I'm a hypnotherapist that practices in New Mexico. My approach is very much body, mind, and spirit. And I'm wondering what the... feedback the doctors have regarding their thoughts, experience regarding PTSD, psychosomatic, anxiety and fear, and working it through hypnosis or hypnotherapy.
Gray.
Well, Brenda, I actually had the opportunity to hear you on the radio recently, and you were talking about your work with your clients with post-traumatic stress disorder, and I was touched by how similar your approach is actually to ours in psychiatry. You know, we've done, obviously in psychiatry, we have a research base that establishes, you know, evidence that what we do is effective. So I want to congratulate you, Brenda, on your work, not having that necessarily that evidence base or knowing that. Do you want me to elaborate further on?
Well, yeah, give us an idea of how you understood what Brenda does compared to what you do, and what are some of the similarities? And she was asking kind of how do you see hypnotherapy fitting into psychosomatic medicine?
Well, she described in hypnotherapy doing a technique which we call exposure therapy. It's a form of psychotherapy. It doesn't involve medications. In which we actually have the person recall the traumatic experience that they've been through and then rework it and reframe it. And ultimately, there's a resolution around that in terms of symptoms.
Does that have to do with kind of recreating connections in the chemical workings of the brain around that particular experience? I'm also thinking about, the EMDR treatment,
yes.
Eye movement.
Desensitization, reprocessing.
Desensitization and reprocessing. Right. Yeah, which also has to do with that kind of revisiting the traumatic experience, the deeply emotionally moving experience in order to kind of change the way that it affects your life. Could you talk a little more?
Yes, EMDR is actually a form of cognitive behavioral therapy, which is exactly exposure therapy, which I was just talking about, is a form of cognitive behavioral therapy. So they're essentially one and the same. The eye movements have just been added on. We don't exactly know whether those are critical to the therapy or not. There's some evidence that probably that may not be the case.
So what's happening in the brain when patients are revisiting this traumatic experience and reprocessing it?
Well, we do know that we can actually see changes in the brain structurally. You know, if you put patients in a scanner that occur in the context of chronic traumas, And that actually changes over time. You can actually put them in a scanner later, and their brain will look different. Now, you know, moment-by-moment changes also in terms of brain function can be tracked as well.
Let's take another call. Anna in Albuquerque. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I just wanted to respond to a question that you asked, Elaine, a few minutes ago, asking if people had preconceived ideas about what psychosomatic means. My mother is a registered nurse, and I would say I was a hypochondriacal child, 1 year missing 53 days of school. And that particular year, I had a teacher I was terrified of. So you didn't feel
so good when you were thinking about going to school and
right.
and were able to get out of going to school because you felt sick, in a sense.
Right. But my mother's attitude was, it's all in your head. And she used the word psychosomatic sometimes, but it was very contemptuously. You know, it's just psychosomatic. Get over it. That sort of attitude. So it's really great to hear about how things are changing. And if there are any responses to my comment, I'll take them off the air.
Well, I love Anna's point about this reaction to emotional stress and trauma as get over it, right? I think we're all pretty familiar. I think our culture, in a sense, supports this idea that when you're experiencing trauma or emotional stress, you should be able to just set it aside, move on, put it down, let it go. How does psychosomatic medicine approach this kind of cultural idea of just get over it? Bill?
It's interesting that one would minimize the fact that something is only in your mind. When I think about most things that occur in life and most of what goes on in our bodies, our mind plays an important role in almost every physical or problem that we have. A good example for my own research is research that I've done in looking at patients with pancreatic cancer who get depressed at a much higher rate than patients with other cancers, and who get depressed actually before they know that they have cancer. And what we've discovered is that there are a set of chemicals called pro-inflammatory cytokines, which are secreted by the tumors. And what they do is they affect the brain, and the brain then thus produces a syndrome of depression and fatigue and sadness and things like
which
that.
Which, of course, would make perfect
It's all in your mind, and you just don't minimize it. Why would you minimize that?
And it makes perfect sense that your body fighting a cancerous tumor would have, that there would be impacts on your entire system.
And the same thing's true with physical pain and chronic pain. Your brain is very actively trying to produce chemicals that inhibit pain. There are these important parts of your brain that send inhibitory pain chemicals down your spinal cord. So there's a lot going on in your brain that's not to be minimized.
Well, and I also am thinking about a Buddhist teacher that I saw speak once who talked about how he quoted that about 80% of the nerves in our gut sends information to our brain and not the other way around, which instantly made me make perfect sense of that idea of trusting your gut, in that, you know, our bodies are telling us stuff all the time, and we don't necessarily recognize, like, oh, my gut is telling me X with, you know, these chemicals or whatever. We think of it as something that we're experiencing in our mind, but we're actually receiving information from other parts of our bodies. Davin, you had a point?
Yeah, I just want to respond to the caller's comment in that, and also what you just brought up, in that the mind and the body are so complex. We understand so little about it that when we get called to see a patient because perhaps, you know, something similar going on to what the patient was going through, a feeling of illness, a feeling of dread, a problem in their life that's going on, we use that as an opportunity to expand the conversation as opposed to reach a conclusion. So, you know, her mother was saying, oh, it's psychosomatic, it's all in your head, get over it. That sort of is reaching a conclusion. And that may be helpful for someone who's going through a problem. We may after sitting and talking with the patient, getting to know them, find that reaching a conclusion that simplifies things would be very helpful to them.
Letting go might be exactly what you need to do.
Exactly, sure. Mm-hmm. Whereas we may also reach the point where expanding the conversation to say, well, you know, hey, what's going on at school? Who are you seeing there? How do you feel? How do you feel at school versus home? So I think that as psychosomatic specialists, we walk in there with a completely open mind to see, you know, what is going on here? What does the patient think is going on? And what will be most helpful for them?
Let's take a few calls now. We have David back on the line. We lost you a moment ago, but we have you back. David, good morning. Can you start your question from the beginning again?
Yes, I can. My concern is with serious mental illness, such as schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, and the psychosis that goes along with these conditions. It seems to me and I have a relative that's been through this very serious event, it seems to me that psychosis probably creates a form of post-traumatic stress disorder after the fact of the psychosis, which is kind of like living in a nightmare that you can't wake up from. So I wonder if your treatment programs address that kind of thing in these kinds of patients.
Well, I hear this all the time in my practice that just having been through an episode of psychosis is extremely traumatic. Many people want to just disconnect and not ever think about it happening again or confront the fact that it has happened. So, yes, we do talk about it commonly, and I agree. I appreciate your question because it's absolutely terrifying and horrifying for people who have been through.
Bill?
Yeah. I think what's happened with the diagnosis of PTSD, as we've understood it, is that as you accurately stated, we used to think that PTSD was just a function of what happened to people who were at war or who lived through earthquakes or big natural disasters. So the concept of what constitutes a trauma that could lead to PTSD.
Being a victim of a violent crime.
Has been broadly expanded. Mm-hmm. So we have patients with cancers going through bone marrow transplantations who get PTSD, and mm-hmm. we've developed treatments for that, cognitive behavioral kind of interventions. In my research, a lot of patients who are seriously medically ill become confused and delirious, and we've had studies done in which we've been able to demonstrate that folks who've been in an intensive care unit have been delirious for days, had hallucinations, don't remember what's happened, suffer from PTSD as well. So there are a broad range of traumas that can lead mm-hmm. to PTSD.
Let's take a few more calls. Maria in Bernalillo, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I am a primary caregiver to a mother with chronic recurrent ovarian cancer. And I have a very particular struggle. I struggle with the whole cultural identity of cancer. And I hate to sound judgmental, and I mean this only in my experience with my mother. I'm not trying to make a social commentary on the culture of cancer. But in my experience, it seems to block the ability to recognize terminal illness and death as a universal experience. And I'm not even sure that makes sense, but
do you mean, let me see if I get you, Maria, in the sense of that, like, people who have cancer, that something different is happening to them than people who are dying from other causes or for other reasons?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I'm disturbed, frankly, by the prevalence of marketing of cancer-related items, from pink toasters to a run for this, a walk for that. And it really has bothered me for the past 6 years in my experience with my mother. And I know that it helps a lot of people. But I don't know. Can you address that?
Yeah, thanks for your call, Maria. And my thoughts are with you and your mom.
Yeah. The thing that I probably would like to say, since we have limited time, is that the experience of being a caregiver for a parent with ovarian cancer, particularly over a six-year period, is a profoundly important role for you to play, but it's not without its burdens and impact. And we've done a great deal of research to show that the caregiving experience is very difficult, there's a lot of movement and development of interventions to support caregivers in their caregiving role because of the stressors of a caregiving role. And I would urge you to seek a little bit of support in that caregiving role, because what I'm hearing is a bit of distress in your voice, and I think perhaps a little bit of support to deal with the difficulties of that situation.
Well, and the commercialization of charities around cancer issues is part of what she was talking about, I think. Uh-huh. I think she was talking about, you know, raising awareness about breast cancer and the kind of pink ribbons and runs and things that may detract from the experiences that the caregiving experiences that people have, where, you know, a pink toaster doesn't make anyone feel any better.
Well, I think what perhaps the call is responding to is that most of these kinds of pink ribbons and this and that focus on the hope for cure, hope for this, hope for that, and they don't address caregiver needs. And so I think the caregiver is often ignored, has been ignored as a focus of attention, and that's changing.
Let me take a few more calls here. Amber in Santa Fe, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks, everyone, for this panel. I'm Amber Gray, and I actually have a question about movement. I'm a LPCC in the area and a dance movement therapist, and I coordinate New Mexico's refugee mental health program. And for 15 years, have worked with survivors of political violence and war with dance movement therapy as a primary modality. And my question for you all is how you see movement, what place it has in psychosomatic medicine. From our perspective, it's the primary language that underlies our capacity for verbal language, you know, especially through a developmental perspective. And I haven't heard anyone speak about movement, so I'd be very interested to hear.
So, Davin, come out of your downward dog and come back to the microphone. I'm just kidding. He's not really doing a downward dog. But you mentioned yoga earlier.
Sure. And I'd like to say, first of all, that the caller's comment is especially appreciated because my wife Carolyn's a physical therapist, and so I often comment that, you know, she sees more psychosomatic phenomena than I do, because those people go to see her when they have a physical symptom, and so she helps me a lot in my work and gives me a lot of insight into how movement and thoughts and feelings are all connected, intimately connected. And so you know, that's something that you know, is the caller has very specific training in how to use movement, how to deal with that. I specifically don't, but we absolutely emphasize people being in their bodies, being aware of their bodies, being in touch with their bodies as part of the process or journey towards understanding, you know, how their mind and their body talk to each other. So you know, yoga is one way to do that. Dance is one way to do that. We have many friends who, you know, are into dance, various different forms, and I think that those people seem to have a wonderful awareness of you know, what's going on in their bodies. So I would say any form of movement where you're paying attention to what's going on, what you're doing, where you are in space will be extremely helpful for any experience that you're, any illness that you're going through.
Does that go back to your idea of meaning-centric behavior, Bill? I'm thinking about, you know, many people have their own choice of physical activity, whether it's mountain biking or swimming or, you know, taking the dog to the park, or there's many different ways to be physically active. But then it's is there some aspect of applying meaning to that physical activity changes?
Sure. Well, there are specific sources of meaning in life through love and relationships, through work. But also experiential sources of meaning beyond love and relationships that have to do with being in nature, being using all of your senses and all of your body to experience life. And I think when you're moving, we live in a culture where movement isn't that, you know, where we spend a lot of time being sedentary. And so being in touch with your body enhances the experience of being alive and meaning. And I was going to add that the earlier caller asked about our own individual spiritual practices. I couldn't do my work in psychosomatic medicine if I didn't go to my Zumba class every week at Equinox.
Well, and we had a caller who couldn't stay on the line but passed their comment on to our call screener wanting to address the issue of sexuality. Anyone care to bring in this issue of sexuality in the context of psychosomatic medicine?
Well, I can sort of speak to that from a historical perspective. I mean, Freud was, I think, one of the original psychosomatic specialists in that he saw a lot of young people in Vienna around the turn of the century who were manifesting neurologic symptoms which didn't seem to have any anatomic basis. And he was the one who first championed the idea that I think that repressed emotions, and in particular repressed sexuality and aggression, can manifest a great deal physically. You know, we've come a long way since then, and so a patient's sexual preferences, their sexual lives, their proclivities, their how they incorporate that into their lifestyle is absolutely a thing that we pay attention to in our evaluations. And so it's as crucial part as any other part of the history.
Well, and sexuality, I think, is a perfect example of the way that mind, body, and spirit can, that we are more accustomed to thinking about sexuality as a physical behavior that also has spiritual and mental qualities to it, in a sense, other than, I want to take a couple more callers, and then I'll come back to each of you for closing comments. Susan in Albuquerque, good morning, you're on the air, and if you could give us your comments real quick so we can make sure to get them all on the air, that'd be great.
Okay, I'd like to make a comment about a person who thinks that everything is going fine, and they see the doctor every year, and then they find out from out of the blue they're thin and they're healthy and they think everything is all right, and they find out they're pre-diabetic to the point that they're 1/10 of a point below what is diabetes, and the stress that causes, and the situation that a lot of people are in that situation, and it seems like some doctors are not paying attention to that. They look at the person and they don't look at what it says on the right there in front of them, pre-diabetic, and how that would affect them. And we're talking about a daily versus situational. I have a friend who gets upset, say, going into a test, and that's when they know they're going to go into a test, and they get upset. But the daily stress of eating, of someone's birthday, of just having a dessert is quite upsetting.
Thanks for your call, Susan. Let's also go to Judy. Judy, can you join us on the air? Thank you.
Yeah.
And keep your comments brief so I can get back to my panel and make sure they have a chance to respond.
What depresses me is the assembly line medicine system. And you're talking about setting up a department of psychosomatic issues, and that seems to feed into that. I'd like to know, what is being done to integrate mind, body, spirit, and technology in the medical industrial complex? Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Judy. So if I could get a quick comment from each of you, kind of in closure about this integration that Judy had mentioned. Go ahead, Bill.
Well, I appreciate all the comments, particularly the last ones. I think one of the things we're trying to do is we're trying to train not just psychiatrists to be aware of the mind-body-spirit connection through the specialty of psychosomatic medicine, but we're spending a great deal of attention trying to teach our medical colleagues about what we've learned in our research about the importance of mind-body and spirit. And, for instance, at Sloan Kettering, we have a communication skills laboratory in which we're training oncologists primarily to be aware of these kinds of issues and to integrate into their oncological care the personal existential component of care.
Thanks to each of you for joining us this morning. Dr. Gray Clark and Dr. Davin Quinn from the University of New Mexico Psychiatry Department, and Dr. William Breitbart, Vice Chair of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. Thanks for joining us this morning on the KUNM Call-In Show. If you'd like to hear parts of this show again, you can visit us online at KUNM.org. Engineering this morning was done by Roman Garcia. We had Michael Hess on doing our phone screening. And next week on the KUNM Call-In Show, Cecil Overgaard will host a conversation about water reuse and whether science can provide solutions for our overtaxed water supply. That's next Thursday at 8 on the KUNM Call-In Show here on KUNM.